Father Coughlin now appears before the microphone in his Easter broadcast. All day long, thousands of worshipers gathered at the shrine of the Little Flower. With pageantry, pomp, and ceremony, in keeping with the rich ritual of the church, the Easter services were executed by well-trained ministers and choristers. Tonight, the church is empty, as Father Coughlin is preparing to speak for the fifth time today. He has an announcement of importance to make as preface to this broadcast. Father Coughlin.
Good evening, my friends. The announcement which I'm scheduled to make tonight is reference to a book. For many months, I've been considering publishing a book containing thoughts which I have not had courage, perhaps, to mention over a microphone. In the pages of this book, which is now on its way to the printer, these thoughts will find expression. I hope they will be of interest to you in this audience. The book will not be for sale. Nothing is for sale from the shrine of the Little Flower. The book will be available only to those who care to trouble themselves in writing for it. During the next 3 weeks, requests will be filed for this book. In the meantime, we shall order just that much paper, just that much binding, which will be required to fill all these requests. There are many things relative to democracy, its success or its failure, the Supreme Court, whether or not it is necessary in our fabric of civilization, the next 10 years and all that it holds forth for us as viewed in my own private mind. Many such things will find its way into the pages of this book. You may have a copy simply by writing for it and by asking for it. Those of you who can afford to defray its expenses, well and good. But I am speaking mostly to those poor persons who cannot afford to make any contribution whatsoever. I would that this book, though it is mine, and though I have no preconceptions of its importance, I would that this book would be in their hands so that at least one solid, uncontroversial word of my stand on those present events will form a lasting record. Those of you who write for it this week will be the first to be honored in receiving this book. Address your mail directly to Woodward and 12 Mile Road, Royal Oak, Michigan. As for this Easter address which I have prepared for you, may I tell you in the quietness of this even hour the story of Easter and its importance in a Christian's life. Christmas, in every aspect, is more or less the feast of Christ's humanity. There is the little baby born in that cold, cold stable at Bethlehem, cradled in straw. Beside him is his wistful mother. Watch that mother bend over the cradle, take the child into her arms, press her lips against his. In a moment later, his little lips are against her breast, just the same as was yours, just the same as your mother did to you. The poor little baby Jesus Christ, of course, is nothing more than a little boy. Those about thought that. We were to live to know differently. But that little boy shall grow up in the throne of his mother's arms. Little Jesus Christ will step down from that throne and become a boy to play with John the Baptist and his little companions. Someday he will be old enough in his maturity to go to the wedding feast of Cana. On that day, though his time had not yet come, though his companions knew not that he was the Son of God, his mother shall ask him to perform a miracle, the first of a long series. Blushingly, he looks into the water pots, and they blush back at him, changed from water into ruddy wine. Oh, in a few short months, this same young man shall stand alongside his mother, consoling her in the death of his foster father, Joseph. In a few short weeks thereafter, he will be found going about Bethania, Jerusalem, up and down Palestine, as he begins to preach his doctrine of the brotherhood of man and the fatherhood of God. One miracle follows another. At one moment he is on the hillsides feeding 5,000 poor persons by having multiplied 5 barley loaves. At another moment, little children are dancing on his knee. Again behold him as he goes down into the home of Jairus to raise his daughter from the dead. See him as he cleanses the lepers. Observe him as he restores sight to the blind, hearing to the deaf, health to the sick. No wonder that a vast throng of people were willing to hail him as their king. No wonder that his fame grew abroad and that his enemies multiplied because of this strange doctrine that he was preaching, a doctrine not of slavery, but of human equality in many senses, a doctrine that whatsoever you do to the least of God's little ones, you do directly to God. Listen to him as he preaches that sermon on the mountainside, holding forth those virtues as the real wealth to be gained in this world and decrying the materialism of his age in which the passing things of life are held in too great importance. Poor Jesus Christ, you know that you are God. Your mother knows it, but those about you do not recognize it. Even though they come about you and acclaim you king, even though they expect of you to be a great leader and restore the lost prestige to the Jewish people. You are well conversant with the prophecies of the Jewish race, dear Jesus. You had read the story of their longing for more than 4,000 years for a real Messiah. One who would come to redeem the Israelitish people. One who would restore to them the kingdom of David. One who would unbind for them the shackles welded by the Romans, by the Assyrians, and by the Egyptians. One who would make of them the chosen people, the real rulers of this world. Oh, you knew the story of the Messiah. But you interpreted it differently than did those your contemporaries. Not far from you in Jerusalem there was Annas and Caiaphas, high priests of that old law. They too had read the ancient scriptures, but they held a different view of this wonderful Messiah who was to come. Oh, what were their thoughts? You know Jesus. You know that they expected the real Messiah to come like a conquering Cyrus of old. They expected him to be a Pharaoh, to be a Pericles, to be an Aristotle, to be a Ptolemy, to be an Alexander the Great, to be a Caesar all crystallized into one.
one with millions of soldiers in his legions, one with a fiery sword, one with justice and no mercy in his heart, one who would re-civilize the world, and one who would convert to ancient Jewry every child born of man. You, Jesus the Messiah, you humbly born of a virgin mother, you, the reputed child of a poor carpenter, you, the meek and mild Jesus, why never would they accept you as the Messiah? Every day, Jesus, we know that you are found teaching in the temple. Every day your eyes fell askance upon those who are defiling that temple with their trafficking in gold and silver, with their trafficking in flesh and blood. Every day your eyes were cast upon those high priests, awaiting from them some sign to cleanse this new Aegean stable of its filth. And every day they repeated their misdemeanors. They cared not for their own people. Oh, dear Jesus, Tuesday of Holy Week, there you come into the temple once again. There you look upon those traders in gold and silver. And there you girded up your loins. You took the very leash of your girdle, and not with moral influence, not with the soft words that was expected from your lips, but with physical violence you drove them from the temple, because that was a house of God which they had defiled and made a den of thieves. Outside, Jesus, those enemies waited for you. You had cast the die. You had convicted yourself of death. Outside that temple doors, the servants of Annas and Caiaphas convened. There they were awaiting. There they were conspiring, and there they determined that they would catch you in your speech. So within a few days, one of them accosts you and says, "Whose coin of the realm is this, Christ?" And you say to them, "Show me a coin of the tribute." Then immediately you say, "Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's." You did not give them the answer which they expected. They thought that you would preach a revolution. They thought that you would give a demagogic answer. They thought that you would compromise with the truth. No compromise from your lips, gentle Jesus. So not satisfied, they follow you through the fields on another day. They find that you are curing men on the Sabbath day, forbidden by the law. And once again they try to catch you as a lawbreaker, as a scofflaw. You answer them by saying, "Which one of you that hath an ass fall in a ditch will not remove it on the Sabbath day? Was man made for the Sabbath, or was the Sabbath made for man?" So all their endeavors to entrap you, Jesus, were failing, until one bolder than the others, knowing the thoughts in the minds of one of your apostles, Judas, the one of the tribe of Judea, approached him. They knew that Judas believed that the Messiah should be a great man coming on a charger with a great sword and a great ambition to conquer the world by force. They knew that Judas had been disillusioned of this false notion of his Messiah, and they knew that Judas would sell you for 30 pieces of silver. Thus came Thursday of Holy Week, when you made your last will and testament, giving to all future generations your flesh to eat and your blood to drink. Then came Gethsemane and the kiss of Judas. Then came Pilate's hall, the home of Annas and Caiaphas, and that mock trial by which you were done to death. In that mock trial, gentle Jesus, no word of reproach escaped your lips. What though they brought in false perjurers to swear false oaths against you? Silence reigns. What though they accosted you with being a consorter of sinners? What though they claimed that you were stirring up the people, that you were a revolutionary, that you were a demagogue? Still silence reigns supreme in your heart and on your lips. And finally, they asked you, art thou the Son of God? You bravely answered, yes, thou hast said it. And then, turning to you, they blasphemed because they claimed that you were a blasphemer. Standing erect in their midst, as you were bayed by those hounds of death, you told them there, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will build it up again. Meaning the temple of your body. In other words, Jesus, I know what you meant by that. I know that you said, I am the Son of God. I am divine. And to prove my divinity, I shall not rest my case at Cana of Galilee with the waters turned to wine. I shall not prove my divinity by having recourse to the miracles of Jairus, of Lazarus, of the widow of Nain, or of the multiplication of the bread. Forget these things, so you intimated. But remember, here's the solid proof. Destroy this temple of my body, and in 3 days I'll build it up again. Oh, I hear those crowds shouting then, away with you, away with you. I see Pontius Pilate weakening as he brings in his Barabbas, one whose hands dripped with the blood of murder, one whose heart was filled with the lust of gold, one whose mind walked with the law of claw and nail as he committed his robbery. And there, this miscreant standing behind you, you crowned with thorns, you whose body was torn with the rabid strokes of that leaden lash. You stand behind this miscreant, and Pilate asked the throng whom they choose, and they said, give us Barabbas. Away with Christ. Then came the story of Jerusalem's streets and the heavy cross you bore. Then came Calvary, and in the hands that had only been lifted to bless were nails placed. In the feet that had only transgressed the acres of Jerusalem, of Palestine, to do good, nails fastened those feet to a cross. And in the heart that loved men, there was a spear for gratitude. Yes, Jesus, they took you down from the cross. Before they took you down, you remembered Christmas, your birthday. You remembered your manhood. And in the taking down, you remembered your divinity. There they place your poor mangled body in a tomb. There they seal it not with the seal of some friend, but with the seal of the Roman state. There they place guards to watch over it. Guards of the Roman legions, lest some friend come to steal away your corpse and stultify those who had crucified you. On Sunday morning, the first day of the week, Jesus, 3 simple women came to your tomb. The great stone had been rolled away. The angel of the tomb said, whom seekest thou, Mary? Jesus of Nazareth, whom you crucified, answered she. The angel retorted by saying, he is risen, he is not here. There's the first Easter morn. There then is proof of the divinity of Jesus Christ. There, thou art God. Thou hast risen from the dead. Thy boast has been made to stand for all centuries. The eternal God, born man and God in Bethlehem, born from the cradle of the tomb, immortal man and immortal God, to defy all criticisms for ages to come.
What means Easter to you and to me, my friends? Of course it means a solidification of this faith that we have in Jesus Christ. None of us doubt for one moment that he is God. Your George Washingtons, your Lincolns, your King George of England, your Napoleons, their lives and their histories are all supported by documentary evidence which we must accept by the eye and by the ear, reading or hearing. But none of them hath the support of all documentary evidence that surrounds your resurrection from the dead. We are more certain of that than we are certain of 1776. We are more sure of that than we are of Caesar's crossing the Rubicon. For you hath established at that moment a new revolution as victor over death, as conqueror over the grave. You cross the Rubicon of life, life everlasting for all of us. But what means Easter to you and to me? It means, my friends, that if Jesus Christ rose triumphant from the dead, if he is the victor over death, so too will you, so too will I be. Easter is very inopportune in many senses to speak of death. Yet this morning, at 10 minutes to 10, as I was preparing for High Mass, with dozens of ministers about me and hundreds of choristers in the church, and in front of more than 3,000 of an audience, I was suddenly called from the sacristy for an old dear friend of mine who had dropped in her dying agony on the granite stone steps of our church. I anointed her with the oils, read over her the last benediction. She was dead in my arms as the High Mass was about to begin. Tonight, my old friend's soul is safe with God in heaven. Tonight, she's spending Easter with the angels and the saints. But more than that, her poor old withered body, shoulders bent by years of toil, eyes dimmed with thousands of drops of tears, and hands gnarled, working for her children. That old body shall soon be placed in a grave, oh, cold, clammy grave. What business hast thou with a body that was the temple of the Holy Ghost? Cold grave, what business hast thou with a little child that has been taken from its mother's breast, with a dear mother that has been taken from daughter's and son's arms, with loving wife that has gone to the beyond, as we think, before her time? Death and grave, thou both are imposters, because today we know that with the resurrection of Christ from the dead, a day shall come when he with power and majesty shall go down to the grave of my old friend that's gone, to the grave of your wife, your husband, your father and mother and daughter and son, and shall lift them up glorious and immortal, to suffer no more, to pain no more, to die no more. Oh, death,
where is thy victory? O death, where, O where is thy sting? Thus it is, my friends, that Easter means that for us. Bethlehem and Christmas prove the humanity of Jesus Christ, a little boy as I was, as you were. Easter proves this boy's divinity. Easter proves this boy's divine leadership. Hundreds of kings and emperors and leaders have come in this earth before. They have led their armies to destruction through seas of blood, and none of them have ever said that they would lift from the dead those to whom they promised their fleeting liberties, those before whose eyes they held out their passing hopes. Oh, take them all. They are pygmies today, when they stand before the risen Jesus Christ, before his empty tomb. There's our leader, a leader who gives us not the passing things that wither tomorrow and fade forever, but a leader who will take the aged, give them back their eternal youth, a leader who will take the crippled and give them back perpetual health, a leader who will take the heartbroken and pour into it the oils of everlasting happiness. Dear Jesus Christ, humbly we adore you before your empty tomb tonight. Humbly we acknowledge you to be true man and true God. Humbly we rededicate our lives to your principles, to your gospel, to yourself. Therefore, like soldiers tonight, soldiers not of that militant class, who braggadociously wield their swords, but soldiers of that haughty class, in whose souls there dwells the Spirit of Christ, we shall all go forth from these our receiving sets, renewing our fealty to God, renewing our love in Christ, and resolving to live a life of martyrdom. Today may be your Calvary. Tomorrow, through the power of Christ, will be your Easter and your resurrection from the dead. Good night, my friends. God bless every one of you.
It will be with keen anticipation that all of us will await the record of the new book which Father Coughlin is preparing. The rule of first come, first served must prevail. No request will be honored after the final order will have been sent to the printer. In writing for your copy, please mail your letter to Father Coughlin at Royal Oak, Michigan. This broadcast originated in the Shrine of the Little Flower at Royal Oak, Michigan, and reached you over a special network.